Radio.
Guinness and God presents Bishop Eugene Hurley, speaking on the topic, Connecting with People on the Fringes of the Church. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
It's lovely to be here, and I just wanted to say how much I appreciate your presence, because John Powell, the great psychologist, says that we can give a lot of things to people by way of presents, like giving things, but nothing substitutes for our presence. By being here, you say more than you can say. And that goes for our work and for our life. I was really interested. We've just started Faith in the Pub, as we call it, and we've just had two nights, and it's terrific. We have it at Shenanigans Pub in Darwin, which is pretty Irish, and it's nice to see that we're in King O'Malley's. With Guinness on Guinness on, what is it? Guinness and God. Because my dad was from County Cork, from a little place near on the West Cork, Dunmanway, near the Ring of Kerry. And so I have a real association with the Irish. And I was thinking tonight that it reminded me of the story of the Irishman who was at the big Catholic ball in Ireland. And this fellow was a bit of a loner and really couldn't dance. But as the evening wore on and he drank more, he began to think he probably could dance. And he had his eye across the room on this lovely lady in red. And right near the end of the night, he finally had enough courage and he thought, this is it. I'm going to go and ask my lovely lady in red to have this waltz. And so he weaved his way over to this lovely lady in red and asked if he may have the waltz. And the reply came back, no, you may not. One, I don't dance. Two, it's not a waltz, it's the national anthem. And three, I'm not your lovely lady in red, I'm the Cardinal Archbishop of Dublin. So I put him in a bit of a disadvantage. I thought of things we could talk about tonight, and I was encouraged by watching the debate, I suppose it became, on Q&A last night with the Cardinal and Richard Dawkins. And I think that's very important for us to develop that sense of knowing what we believe, why we believe it, and then live it out. Know what we believe and why we believe it and to live it out. And there is a fashion around at the moment which says you can be as aggressive and as attacking as you like about atheism, agnosticism, secularism, but you daren't mention anything about Christianity. That if you do, that you're regarded as having left your brains at the door. That when you come in, you kind of left your reason and left your good judgment at the door, because Christianity is just simply crazy, nonsensical. I think it's important for us to understand that theology is built on philosophy, and that if our philosophy is not right, then our theology is not right. That's why we would talk about philosophy as the handmaid of theology. But having said that, it's eminently reasonable that we would have belief, and belief in God, and belief in the universe, and so on. One of the interesting things to me is that it's fashionable now for people to say, listen, I'm a real practical bloke. Like, I believe in what I can touch and eat, nothing else, none of that other stuff. This is what I believe in. Touch and eat, nothing else. Thank you. And I was just thinking, I was on a plane coming down late last night, and the fellow that's sitting alongside me, if I'd have said to him, where are we going? He would have said, oh, well, I'm going to Adelaide and then changing over and going to Canberra. I said, oh, that's good. Oh, you've got a GPS in your pocket, have you? You actually know where we're going. And he said, oh, I've got a ticket. I said, yeah, but where are we going? Do you know how we're going to get there? Is there anybody up the front of this thing? Oh, yeah. Are they? Are they pilots? Yeah. You already had a look at their, you know, their papers, have you? Is there any petrol in this thing? Are the tyres pumped up? Like, we just sit there like newts with a bit of paper which says this is where we're going. I believe all this. And this is from a guy who says, I only believe what I can touch and eat. And here he's putting his life at risk and nothing, only a bit of paper. Like, it's crazy for people to talk like that, and we shouldn't allow people to get away with it because it isn't true. Not because it's a religious thing, but it's just rubbish. It's not true. And I think we need to be a bit more kind of assertive about ourselves. I think it's also good not for us to be always answering questions, difficult questions. It's easy to ask difficult questions. That's an easy thing to do. But I think we need to be a little more assertive in our own application of our faith. Often people would say to you, oh, you mob, you're against abortion. I'd say, no, we're for life, the sacredness of every life. Every person is special, beautiful, in the image of God, and no one has a right to take that life. Don't you believe that? Who will you leave it up to? Will doctors decide? Will Dr. Singer, who says that parents should have the right until after 3 days to decide whether they want their kid to live or not, and that some animals have got more right than that child. Is this what you believe? We don't have to be defending all the time. People say, you believe, you know, you're against euthanasia. No, we're not. We're against the dignity of everybody to die in peace and painless, surrounded by their family and loved ones, not to be shuffled off because they're a nuisance. What do you believe? You're against divorce. No, we're not, but we're for lifelong and total commitment of wife and husband to each other so they provide a warm and beautiful home for kids. What are you on about? What are you on about? What do you believe about this? We don't have to be answering all the difficult questions all the time. It's easy to ask the difficult question. And so I think that our faith, it just seems to me, it seems to me to be unreasonable not to believe in God, not to understand that there is a God. One of the great examples, I suppose, of a great astronomer, 17th century astronomer, Athanasius Kircher, who's about 1601 to 70 around there, is a German. Studied in Paderborn, up in the north of Germany. But he was a brilliant astronomer, and they still talk about him now if you Google him. And one of the things he did was taught postdoctoral students. This was his level of kind of expertise. And so one of the postdoctoral students he had was always into him because he was a practicing Catholic and a brilliant scientist. He said, you've got to be schizophrenic, you can't be both. How can you believe in God and all that stuff and be a brilliant scientist? And he never defended himself. But over many years, he had worked on a moving model of the galaxy. You know, you turn the handle and everything went the way it was supposed to do in perfect harmony according to what they knew of the galaxy. And so he finished it off one weekend in the laboratory and left it there, came in late on the Monday, and all the students are gathered round it, oohing and ahhing, and can't wait for the professor to get in to congratulate him. And one of the first to congratulate him was this student who was always mocking him. And he said, fantastic, you know, professor, congratulations, it's fantastic, you know. And eventually the professor said, what are you talking about? He said, oh, this thing here is beautiful, you know, congratulations. He said, oh, I didn't do that. And he said, well, who did? Who did? If you didn't do it, who did? We think, come on, it was you, wasn't it? He said, no. And he said, well, who? He said, I think it might have just happened over the weekend. And this fella said, don't give me that. Don't fool around. Who made it? And that's when Kircher said, your logic amazes me. That you demand to know who, intellectually, who made this thing, which is just a mimicking of something that we know works and that's out there in the universe, and yet you say to me, no one made the original. He didn't say your faith amazes me. He said your logic amazes me. And I think that sometimes we can get kind of battered into a corner where we kind of think, well, maybe I can't explain all this. Maybe it is a bit airy-fairy. Maybe it is sort of Spider-Man and Mickey Mouse. I think we really need to be confident in what we believe and know why we believe it and be assertive about it, not aggressive, but assertive about it, because it's true. It's philosophically true. And that's an important thing for theology to be built on. And so I think it's not only eminently rational to understand the designer, that we would talk in philosophical terms, we would say that design demands an intellect. Design, as opposed to chaos, demands, not could have, an intellect. Like 2 and 2 are 4. Design demands an intellect. I mean, you look at 250 Commodores, you know, V8s, you open the bonnet, the first thing you say is, who put this together? And if someone said the cat, you know, they'd know you were joking or on drugs, because they'd say, somebody did it. Why would somebody have to do it? Because you need an intellect for that sort of design. So, leaving that for a minute, and there might be some questions about it later that we can come back to that. But I do think we were talking tonight, or wanted to talk a bit about tonight, in the context of the church, how do we interact with people on the fringes? One of the things, for me anyway, is important, and you may take a contrary view, but for me one of the things that's important is to understand what the church is and to have a vision of the church. Because in I'm a therapist by trade, but in counselling and therapy, there's a thing called vision therapy. John Powell, a psychologist, probably the best promoter of that. Other people call it different things. He calls it vision therapy. How we see things will dictate our emotional response. Can I say that again, because it's important? He says, how we see things or vision things will dictate our emotional response. He uses an example. He said, this guy had a pathological fear of snakes. Like, he wasn't just frightened of snakes, but he had a pathological fear of snakes. And so he comes home to this little wooded area this night in the near darkness, and there's this big snake across the grass. And he's got to get out, and he freezes, and he's got all the typical signs of terror. He's shaking, he's perspiring, he can't concentrate. So he gets out, and in sheer terror he just cuts the thing up into 100 bits and goes inside, and he's shaking, has a drink, can't settle, can't concentrate. He goes out in the morning to have a look at what he's done, and what he's actually done is he's cut up the garden hose into about 100 pieces. And so Powell takes him back and said, what did you see last night? What did you see? What was your vision? And what was the emotional response? What did you see today? And what was your emotional response? He was trying to make the point that how we see something will dictate our emotional response. And one of the things we need to have a clear idea about, I think, is the church itself. And John Paul II, in a reasonably obscure documentary or a document called Incarnationis Mysterium, the mystery of incarnation. It was the launching of the Great Jubilee. And this is what he said in it. And I know it by heart. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. He says, the church is in the world as the living presence of the love of God, reaching down to every human weakness in order to gather it into his merciful embrace. Can I say that again? He says, the church is in the world, not outside the world, not apart from the world, not above the world. The church is in the world. As the living presence of God? No. As the living presence of the love of God, reaching down to every human weakness. Why? To kick it, to beat it to death. Reaching down to every human weakness in order to gather it into his merciful embrace. What a beautiful vision of the church. And if we see the church like that, everything we do, everything we talk about, everybody we meet, every challenge we have, has to fit into that vision of the church. And I just think, as an example, and this is just one example, because it's my experience and you'll have your own. But when I was a parish priest, I was a parish priest in a place for 18 years, so I actually literally saw lots of little kids born. Literally saw them born, sometimes because of my friends, sometimes because it was going to be a tragedy. You know, some of you would know what an anencephalic child is. It's a child born without any top on its head, and it's really quite disturbing, enormously disturbing to parents and nursing staff. Sometimes you'd be there for that. But I knew this lady in the hospital. I knew she was a Catholic. I knew she wasn't going to Mass. We were very good friends. And I was just delighted one day when I was processing out to come into Mass, I saw this lady drive into the car park. And I thought, yes, you know, she's at Mass, terrific. But she didn't come in. And then I saw her again one time. She didn't come in. So the next time I went to the hospital, I was just mucking around because I thought she must be called back to the hospital because she was a specialist sister. And I just said to her jokingly, we'll call her Bernadette because that's not her name. I said, Bernadette, I'm going to charge you parking soon. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, well, I see you come into the park, but you know, into our park, and you don't come to Mass. I'm going to put a parking station there. And I thought, you know, I was being a bit funny, I thought. But when I looked at her, she was really quite serious. She said, I can't come in. I said, what do you mean you can't come in? She said, I can't come in. I've tried, but I can't come in. I said, what are you talking about? And then she began to cry. You know, we're in the hospital. So I just took her aside. She said, what actually transpired is that when she was a young person touring the continent, as lots of young people do, some buffhead got her pregnant and then put enormous pressure on her to have an abortion. Here she is some 20, 30 years later, said, I can't come in there with all those good people. I just can't do it. So I said to her, calling her Bernadette, I said, Bernadette, I want you to come to Mass next week. Come into the car park. And you don't have to come in because we're coming out. Because I can't be in there saying Mass as a sinful person with all those other people that I know are sinful people, knowing that you're outside because you're a sinful person. So I promise you, if you don't come in, we're coming out. I'll just say to the people, it's a nice day, I'd like to say Mass in the car park today. We'll take a little altar out and we'll say Mass out there. Because I'm not prepared to say Mass in the church with you outside. And I can only say to you that she is probably the most fervent, Mass-attending, wonderful Catholic that I know. Because the church is in the world as the living presence of the love of God. She knew in her mind that she had offended God so badly that she could never enter the church again. I mean, that's just not true. And we have to live our lives in such a way that people begin to see the church as the church of Jesus Christ, with the heart of Jesus, with the forgiveness of Jesus, with the challenge of Jesus, with the justice of Jesus. I was just so thrilled the other day. Well, there are a number of things I could talk about, but I was just so thrilled the other day. I got a message from somebody, and I'll just tell you the little story about them. People talk about, you know, turning the boats around. Well, let me tell you this story, and I ask you whether you would want to turn this boat around. I don't give a damn about the boats, but what I do know is they're full of people. That's what I know. And I'll tell you this story about just this little couple, and then you decide whether you think it's good policy to turn that boat around. I was talking to this... I visited the detention centre in Darwin and just introducing myself, ran, and one of the interpreters said, could you come and see this couple? And they explained to me through the interpreter that they were Catholics. They were caught up in the Sri Lankan Tamil, you know, that final brutal end to that long war. Forgetting who was what. This young couple, they were showing me the photos of their family. They lived opposite the church. They had a little business. The man used to go over and open the church for the priest and serve mass for him every morning, duck back over to his business. By that stage, his wife could be free to go and do. They were showing me the three little kids in the photo. They had one with them, a little girl about eight, and they were showing me the photos through the interpreter of little twins, a little boy and a little girl, and their baptism and so on. The room in the detention centre was like a little grotto. They had statues and rosary beads and all of that. And so we had this lovely conversation about their family and so on. And then I asked them what happened. And the mother began to tell me that they were rounded up and put into a compound. And she said from time to time they would be shelled in the compound. And she was saying, with the little twins who were only about thus high, she used to fill a pantyhose with dirt and make a little bunker for them so that they wouldn't get hurt if something happened. And then she began to convulse with sorrow and tears, and eventually told me that they were shelled, and the little boy had his legs blown off and the little girl had her stomach blown out, and it took them 3 days to die. And she was screaming at me, how could I leave them, how could I leave them? She was badly wounded. The husband's arm was all out of whack. The only one that wasn't hurt was the little girl, about eight, who had nightmares and screamed every night. I heard from them, you know, I was working with them, and then the next thing I knew they were transferred somewhere. But I was so pleased the other day that they finally got a visa and rang from a place in Victoria where they're settling just to say thank you. But I just thought to myself, why would anyone want to turn that boat around? The church is in the world as the living presence of the love of God, reaching down to every human weakness. Why would we not be angry about somebody saying, they don't deserve to be here. They're queue jumpers and they don't deserve to be here. That's simply not true. While I was there that particular day, I could tell you many stories about asylum seekers and refugees. It's followed me as a bishop wherever I've been. But that same day, the interpreter asked me, would I please come and talk to a young woman? I said, look, I'm happy to, but you must tell her that I'm a man, and I'm a Christian, because she may be Muslim and want to talk to a woman or one of her own faith. So he came back and said, no, that's fine. So I went and talked to this beautiful young woman, and she told me much the same about being rounded up, put in a compound, except that once they were in the compound, the soldiers came and took about 15 of the prettiest girls, took them back to the barracks and raped them brutally and incessantly till she was so ill they'd actually take her to a clinic where somebody recognised her and then bribed their way to get her out. But as I was talking to her, you could see she was glazed over. And as a therapist, after six or seven sessions, you might suggest to the woman, because most people who are raped, men and women, would all say, it's a universal thing, that's how I feel dirty. I only had about 10 minutes, so I said to her, look, I don't know whether this is so for you, but often people who share this with me would say that they feel dirty. And as I watched the interpreter get to that word, you could see her saying, yes, yes. And I was trying to say to her, you're beautiful and you're pure and wonderful. Something awful's happened to you by people who are awful, but you are perfect. And I was trying to say, if you had a 17-year-old daughter and she got raped coming home from university, would you then say to her, now you're dirty? And of course she said, no, no, no. I said, and neither are you. Something awful's happened to you. But she was quite sort of suicidal, you know, you could sense that. The next time I went back, she had gone and I don't know where. Why would we turn her back? Why would we want her not to come here? And why would we not want to care for her? The church is in the world as the living presence of the love of God, reaching down to every human weakness in order to gather it into his merciful embrace. No getting away from that. I was the bishop when they opened Woomera. And I went there the first time I went there. I was very confronted by the fact that all the people had their lips sewn up and were just laying in the sun, hoping to die. And I don't know whether this young man, John, who was an intelligent and engaging young man and a Catholic, I don't know whether he understood, but the lesson for me was powerful when I said Mass in a little corner of that place and he knelt in front of me with his lips sewn up so that he couldn't receive communion. I don't know whether he understood how powerful that message was for me, that you can't celebrate the Eucharist in the presence of such injustice. While I was also there on another occasion, I saw a young man swan dive from much higher than this, swan dive into the razor wire. And if you try and get somebody off the razor wire, you know, when it's marked like this, every which way you pull, the other pulls harder. You don't do that for entertainment. Like that, it isn't a joke, it's not funny. It's just people driven to absolute desperation. John, this intelligent, brilliant young man, spent probably 3-4 years there. He's finished up almost unintelligent. We've managed to break him and to then give him his freedom. Another woman. Where's Danielle? How am I going? 5 minutes. I'll just tell you this very quick story. In the diocese where I was as bishop, we used to have an annual assembly, which was terrific. You know, to have people from all around our fantastically big diocese come together for a few days. We'd have the chrism mass and all of that. And we would try and have a theme for the 2 days and we'd try and, you know, work it out of our own people. This time we were talking about family. And so we had fathers of families and daughters and, you know, and talking about families in rural areas, so whatever. And so we talked about families in the detention centre. And so this woman, Rosemary, got up and talked about that she'd been writing to a Muslim woman in Woomera for months. And the little daughter of the Muslim woman would translate and they'd write back. So this was going on for months. She had the opportunity to drive about 3.5 hours up to Woomera and go in with the priest one day because the sister wasn't there. And she was telling this story. She said, as soon as I got in there, I almost knew who she was. I didn't have to be told. We ran to each other, embraced each other, and we bridged all the gaps of culture and religion and colour and everything. We were just two mothers hugging each other. It was beautiful. We spent a lovely time together. She said, then when I came out of there and that gate slammed behind me, I was full of confused feelings. It was lovely to see her, but why is she in there? Why am I out of here? Why are we doing this? And she said, you can understand then how I felt 3 days later when they rang me and said that woman had hung herself. And they'd cut her down and she's now again pretty incapable. And now, as she said, now she and her daughter are free. You know, why would we do that to somebody? It doesn't make sense. And so I'll go to questions and stuff, but there's something beautiful here, I think, that I just wanted to share with you. This is, this is a really challenging, beautiful thing by a fellow who's a songwriter, Michael Lilly. Some of you would know him, and he writes great lyrics. But just let me read you this, and then I'll stop, because it's about the challenge of getting up and doing stuff, really kind of making a difference. He says, "We rest here while we can, but we hear the ocean calling in our dreams, and we know that by morning the wind will fill our sails to test the seams. The calm is on the water, and part of us would linger by the shore. For ships are safe in the harbour, but that's not what ships are for. And the church is the bark of Peter. The church is a ship. It's not meant to be in the harbour. The ship's meant to be out there in the rough water. The only time we're in harbour is to get fixed up and go again. Ships are meant to take treasure from one place to another." And so the church, it's a wonderful and an extraordinary thing to be part of the church. I've always found it an enormous mystery to me why I ever finished up a priest. I just think it's an extraordinary, I think it's a joke in a way by God to say, "I'll take this buffhead and make him a priest." That's just how clever I am. And I've always found it an enormous privilege to be a priest every day of my life. And I can only share with you, I've been a priest now 46 or something years, and I've never been more excited about it than this very day. It's an extraordinary privilege to be a priest. And one of the beautiful things I've lived to see is to see that the young church, young people, are doing what they've been asked to do, which is to be the heart of the church, the young heart of the church. And I just, I'm amazed at your goodness. I'm inspired by your fidelity, and I'm challenged by your prayerfulness. I think it's a great privilege to have lived long enough to have shared, to see what's happening, particularly led, as I say, by young people. So thank you very much for having me, and I'll be just delighted to answer any questions I can.
That was Bishop Eugene Hurley on Connecting with People on the Fringes of the Church. Guinness and God is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more, visit cradio.org.au.